Welcome to This Is Money podcast, sponsored by Charles Stanley Direct. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and Simon Lambert today is Lee Boyce. And coming up, it's that special time of year. Yes, it's the This Is Money annual review episode, the opportunity for Simon and Lee to assess the last 12 months, and oh, what a 12 months it's been, and to look ahead to 2025. We'll take a look at what's happened to interest, savings and mortgage rates, house prices and investments. We've had changes of governments on both sides of the pond. So what will that mean for our money next year? And what other big changes can we expect? Don't forget to stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
Take control of your finances with Charles Stanley Direct. Invest, save, coach or plan. Using technology where it's helpful and people where it matters. Our website and app make trading cost-effective and flexible. But we're more than just an online investment service. We're here for you regardless of your financial needs or if your life takes an unexpected turn. Your finances, your way. Take control today with Charles Stanley Direct. Sign up now.
Investment involves risk.
But first, down but not out. Like a horrible, lingering cold, you think you're finally shaken off. Up it pops close to Christmas, threatening all your fun. Yes, it's inflation. This week we got news that the cost of living in November hit its highest level in 8 months at 2.6% and remains above the Bank of England's target of 2%. It came, therefore, as no surprise that the following day interest rates were held at 4.75%. There was a thought last year that at one time rates might see six cuts through 2024. We didn't get that. So what has the impact been on our money and what does 2025 hold in store? Simon Lee, welcome. Simon, the latest decision then for interest rates actually wasn't unanimous. What was the thinking behind it?
Well, we got a hold. Any hope of a cut, I think, had long since vanished. There were even some suggesting that we might need to put rates up if inflation is picking up again. But the inflation figure that arrived this week, 2.6%, was in line with expectations pretty much, but it's high. It's not what people wanted to see. Services inflation is still running hot at 5%. We're also seeing a scenario where businesses are putting up prices to cover the national insurance raid on employees, national insurance contributions that the government outlined in the budget. At the same time as possibly not seeing their own prices fall as quickly as they'd like. And that's all feeding through to the consumer as well. But within those figures, you've got to look at some specific things which the Bank of England may choose to ignore. So, for example, petrol prices were responsible for a big bump and energy bills going up responsible for a big bump. But the Bank of England's rate setters decided to hold rates via vote of 6-3. And there were three who wanted to cut, interestingly.
I mean, there was no surprise that it stayed, but what was the thinking behind those that wanted to cut?
Well, those that wanted to cut can see the economy slowing. And in fact, Andrew Bailey, Bank of England boss, came out and warned that basically we were going to see zero growth as far as, you know, his predictions were. Now, these predictions are often very wrong in terms of what's going to happen to the economy, just like the predictions on what's going to happen to interest rates are regularly wrong. So, for example, at the start of this year, we were expecting four interest rate cuts this year, or perhaps even more. Anybody looking at the situation going, well, why would the Bank of England cut interest rates four or more times this year? It didn't matter because the common sense suggested that. The idea was the markets were thinking four or five cuts, maybe this year and then some more next year. We've got nowhere near to that. But the issues with, the Bank of England's rate setters wanting to cut now is that they are thinking they need to get ahead of the fact that the economy is slowing down, which is not really what we wanted to be hearing at this stage in the year. What we wanted to be hearing at this stage in the year was that the economy was picking up and we were about to shift into a really good 2025. I mean, I'm not going to rake over the coals of the miserabilism, but I'm not entirely convinced that our new government has read the room and got the mood music right. You can't hold politicians entirely responsible because, you know, they can only say what they say and do what they do. But they have definitely killed off a very large amount of confidence, hope, upbeat sentiment that came with, a new government, with the election and so on. Now they're promising that that growth is going to come, and they're outlining plans left, right, and centre. We've got milestones, we've got aims, we've got goals, we've got things coming out of our ears. We're going to build 1.5 million houses. Conversation this week at lunch amongst some work friends, not on the team, but people in the wider thing. Basically, one of them said, "Who's going to build these houses?" Like, literally, like, who's going to build these houses? We're doing this whole thing the wrong way round. We don't have the people to build the houses. We don't have the brickies. We don't have the electricians. We don't have the plumbers. Like, forget arguing about building on fields. Like, we can pass all those fields through planning permission if you want, but there's nobody to actually build the houses. And if we do find those people to build the houses, we're going to have to pay them so much money that it's going to drive inflation up, problem that we have. So I think what's happened is we've got the scenario where short-term growth has been dampened, by the mood, by the sentiment, maybe just by reality. Maybe it's not the government's fault at all. Long-term, potentially we might get that growth, but we're going to have to be waiting a while. In the meantime, to answer your question, the Bank of England's rate setters are thinking, well, maybe we might need to cut rates again to stimulate the economy because things are slowing down.
So this is the latest decision. Let's take a look throughout the year, the impact that that's had. There was, as I said at the start, the idea that there would be many more rate cuts than we got. Hasn't happened. Not great for those with mortgages, better for those with savings accounts, presumably.
Yeah, you're right, Georgie. Potentially, we might have been sitting here thinking there might have been another cut by now. That 6-3 vote, three people in the Monetary Policy Committee did actually vote for a cut to get it down to 4.5%. Was that the right decision before Christmas? The jury's out. There's lots of pressure to start bringing that down a little bit more. But from that inflation rate of 2.6% and having a look at what others are predicting now. We've gone from a kind of, it was pretty nailed on for probably like four cuts next year. Now traders are pricing in two cuts next year of 25 basis points per cut. So 4.25% end of the year. Now there are some forecasters that are more bullish on that, saying that that's, too low. That's not what's going to happen, and there's still going to be more cuts than that, 3.5%. Something like that. But there's definitely, as Simon said, the mood music has changed ever so slightly, I would say, in regards to cuts. Now, mortgage rates, we've had a bit of a steadier we've had a bit of a steadier year, I would say, this year. You've got to remember, in the sort of summer of 2023, we had a sort of average 2-year fix of 6.86%. We had an average 5-year fix of something like 6.37%. It all dropped off sort of at the start of this year. So by February, average 2-year fix was 5.56%. Average 2-year fix 5.56%. Average 5-year fix 5.18%. They've started to creep up again ever so slightly. And these are the average rates. These aren't the very best rates, which are usually reserved for those that have got big deposits, lots of equity in their home. We've had some cuts again recently from some of the banks, and we've been edging back down to 4% again. What that says to me, and what has gone on largely this year in terms of mortgage rates, is that it's just been a lot more stable. It's been a lot more within, a kind of percentage point, rather than a couple of years where it was jumping around. We were all a bit confused about where they were actually going. Now, of course, mortgage rates are linked a little bit to base rate, but they're not exclusively linked to base rate. Now, if you're on an SVR, you probably would get a cut pretty quickly if you're on one of those deals. But most people that own a home are on a 2-year fix, a 5-year fix. Lots of people still coming up to remortgage next year, the year after, coming off of the back of ultra low mortgage rates that are going to come into a market now where you're looking at more like 4 or 5, 6%. It hasn't moved around that much at all this year. And I think that most people have got used to the higher cost of a monthly mortgage. And a lot of what is out there is already priced in to mortgage rates. But I think what a lot of homeowners and a lot of people that are potentially thinking about getting onto the property ladder, buy-to-let investors, all of these people are kind of hoping that there will be some deeper cuts coming in terms of base rate, and that will drive potentially mortgage rates lower. I think that's what a lot of people are kind of hoping for. On the savings front, we started this year having come off the tail end of some of the best rates for a very, very long time. It all peaked really at the end of 2023. You could get plus 6% on your money, but that was at a time when inflation was still riding fairly high. This year again, it's been fairly stable, I'd say, Georgie, in terms of the savings front. A lot of the best rates, the very, very best rates, have been driven by competition amongst banks. Sorry, competition not amongst banks and building societies. The usual players haven't been largely involved this year at the top of the very top of the best buy tables. It's been more driven by things like trading platforms and new upstarts. And we see the end of a 5%. Easy access savings rate. I think that's it, and then another one pops up, and that seems to be the case at the moment. So it's still very possible to get a good return on your savings versus inflation, which is important. But we have this last couple of months, NS&I, pretty big bellwether of where savings rates are going and what's going on in the wider market. Couple of cuts on all sorts of products, from premium bonds to income bonds, that kind of thing. So it feels like savings rates are starting to drop fairly significantly. What happens into the new year is, I would say, quite possibly we're at the point where 4, 4.5% is going to be more like the norm, and then we've all got all eyes on base rate and where that goes.
How can you find the best deal at the minute, Lee?
Well, you come into thisismoney.co.uk slash savings,
Obviously.
of course, Georgie. And you have a look at our savings tables and see what's out there. It depends also what you want to do with your money. If you're not maxing out your ISA, ISA rates are actually the rates have kind of held up probably the best out of everything. You can still get 4.9% with trading 212. If you're not happy to go and use an investment platform like that, Paragon, Monument Bank, Mansfield Build Society, Chip, Virgin Money, they're all paying 4.5%. So worth having a look. Fixed rates actually have started to drop below the best easy access rate. So 4.5% is the best on a 1 year ISA. In terms of just a bread and butter easy access account, that's not a cash ISA, fairly similar rates again available. If you have a look at what we've got in our best buy tables, all independent. Can't pay to be at the top of our best buy tables. We compile them on a daily basis. Sylvia Morris, savings guru, will go and actually, I shouldn't call her the savings guru. So the savings oracle of This Is Money will gives us daily updates on the movers and shakers. But quite interestingly, we're still at a position where you can get a better rate of return on your savings for fixing for 1 year than you can for any other term. 2 years, 3 years, 5 years, you can still get a better rate by fixing for 1 year. So there's lots of rates out there. I'd say lots of bonus rates and all of that kind of thing. Only this week, Chase Bank actually has come out with a bonus rate for easy access, so you can get 5%. Again, on an easy access with Chase Bank, that includes a 1.5% bonus for 6 months. But there's still good rates out there, is what I'm trying to say.
Goodly.
It's good to be earning, making a return on your money versus inflation. Making sure your money's not in those big banks. Those big banks' easy access rates have not budged an inch. 1.5% a lot of them offer. Some of them do have loyalty accounts, and you have to go and fish them out and go and find them, and you have to meet certain criteria. But just make sure that you're getting the right return on your money, Georgie. That's what I would say. There's plenty of choice out there for savers.
Simon, I want to get into the politics aspect of finances shortly, as well as house prices, investing, all that sort of thing. But you mentioned something that I just wanted to pick up on, and that's about predictions. Quite often, predictions are wrong. One, why are they so out? Like, what are they based on? And obviously, it depends, I suppose, on what you're predicting, but how much, should me, you, the average man, woman in the street, as it were, base their financial decisions? Because a lot of financial decisions, fixing mortgages, for example, are based on what you think is going to happen. So, how much do we take what these predictions are when so often they're wrong? And why do they bother making predictions if so often they're wrong?
To answer your last question first, it's so that we have things to write about and talk about. They need to make predictions. Otherwise, what would we do?
That's true. That is true.
So it's very important that actually we have these predictions so that we can cover them. Why are they so often wrong? Because stuff happens that people can't predict. You can't accurately predict the future entirely. Otherwise, you probably wouldn't be involved in the making predictions game. You'd be involved in the making unbelievable amounts of money and never raising your head above the parapet to tell anyone else what was going to happen because you make it out like a bandit game. So over the past year, for example, something happened that people didn't think was going to happen, which was the US economy was much stronger than people thought. You know, if you go back, you don't have to go back that long ago for everyone to be saying there was no way the Fed was going to pull off the soft landing and all that kind of stuff. And in the UK, that the rapid rise in interest rates and mortgage rates was going to cause serious problems for the economy. I personally am absolutely shocked that the dramatic rise in mortgage rates has not caused more of a problem in the UK economy, because whilst there is only 30% of people with a mortgage, you know, there's 30% of mortgaged homeowners, 30% of homeowners who own their property outright, and 30% of people renting who are impacted by higher mortgage rates and are actually getting really hit hard at the moment, renters are. Now, I would have said that the number of people with mortgages was large enough, and the jump in mortgage costs of hundreds of pounds per month was substantial enough that it would seriously dent the economy and people's finances. But people seem to have ridden it out. People are eating into their savings where they can. They're cutting back. I mean, it is definitely harming the economy, but what you're not seeing is a shock scenario. I think what you'd need to see is some form of scenario where this happens at the same time as you saw unemployment spike for some reason or something like that. Whereas what we've seen is employment has remained relatively high. Wage rises have remained relatively high coming off the back of the cost of living crisis. The wage rises are now actually wage rises in real terms. And people are just finding money where they can to put towards it, because ultimately you've got to keep paying those mortgage bills. And so actually they've kind of just sucked it up. It has had a detrimental impact on people's standards of living. If you suddenly have to pay £400 a month more than you did before for your mortgage, well, your standard of living is going to go down substantially. You're either going to have to not do stuff that you could previously do. You are going to have to cut back on things that you might have liked to do, like bigger ticket stuff. And you're not going to be able to save and invest in the same way. And I think that's where we're going to see the impact. But the impact that we're seeing is longer and slower. Yeah, you know, it's one of the reasons why pubs are shut half the time now. People aren't going into them, don't have the money. And also the pubs' costs have gone up by so much. It's one of the reasons why restaurants tell you that they're struggling. They don't have so many people eating out. It's one of the reasons why shops tell you that they're struggling and so on. I mean, what you can do, though, to go back to your question about the predictions, is you can focus on the things that you do know. So, for example, to go back to what Lee was saying about savings, I would say the most important thing you can do is make sure that you've got your savings in a cash ISA. If you are saving in cash, get it into a cash ISA, because what you don't want is for tax to be eating some of that return. Because then all of a sudden, if you're a basic rate taxpayer and you get more than a personal savings allowance of £1,000 a year, you're going to be losing the equivalent of 20% on your interest rate. But if you're a higher rate taxpayer, of which many, many more people are now, and lots of people listening to this podcast will be, you only get a £500 personal savings allowance and you'll be losing 40% of your interest rate. And if you're an additional rate taxpayer, if you're lucky enough to be paid more than £125,000 a year, you get no personal savings allowance and you'll be losing 45% of it. So put your money into a cash ISA. That's like the single most important thing you can do. And it will make a bigger difference than whether you're getting a 4.7% rate or a 4.5% rate overall. Your mortgage, for example, you know, you don't know what's going to happen to mortgage rates. You don't know what's going to happen to interest rates. We just talked about that. You do know when your mortgage is up, though. You will know when you need to remortgage. And if you don't know, you can look it up quite easily. So you can start to plan ahead. And just like a Bank of England statistic here, over 3 million or 35% of mortgage accounts are still paying rates of less than 3%, right? The majority of whom will have their fixed rate expire before the end of 2026. Now, that's a lot of people, okay? So for the typical owner-occupier, rolling off a fixed rate between June 2024 and the end of 2026, their monthly mortgage payments are projected to increase by around £180, or 28%. Within that average, a relatively small proportion are likely to experience some very large increases. Around 400,000 households will see an increase in their payment of 50% or more. So if your mortgage bill is going to go up by lots, plan ahead, start to be, you know, adjusting your budget now ahead of time, salting some money away to help carry you over if you need to, but also looking at locking into a rate. At the moment, rates aren't bad. They're not as good as they were. They were below 4%. They're now 4.2% for the best five-year fixes, and lots of people be paying more than that. You can book in a rate up to 6 months in advance, speak to a broker, go to thisismoney.co.uk/mortgage-finder. You can basically plug in your home value, your mortgage size, and our partner LNC will tell you, you know, the best mortgages that you can apply for. You can speak to them for free, for example, and they'll help you out. You don't have to speak to them. You can speak to someone else. These are just the people that we work with that can help you out. But it means that at least, you know, you're forewarned and you know what's going to happen.
Quite. Lee, sticking with homes, I just want to talk about house prices, if I might. Nationwide reckon the average homeowner could see their house price rise by almost £11,000 next year. What are the predictions here? What's this down to?
Well, let me tell you about what's happened this year first, Georgie. Let's take it for this year and what's going on. So we obviously have a lot of house price indexes in this country and a lot of kind of different information and data that does different things. So first of all, let's start with the Office for National Statistics. So the ONS saying that the typical home has increased around about £10,000 in the year to October. Now, the reason why I say in the year to October is because the ONS works a little bit behind the other indexes. But it suggests that the average UK home, £292,000 in October, which is up from £282,000 at the same time last year, so 3.4%. We then have Halifax. Halifax say that house prices are up 4.8%. That's £14,468. That's the strongest level since November 2022. And Nationwide are saying 3.7%. The biggest annual rise in 2 years. So they're all painting a relatively similar picture. It's been a solid year for house price growth, which is interesting given the backdrop of what's happened with mortgage rates. But it suggests that, again, we'll go back to the stability that I was talking about earlier. There's a lot more confidence in the property market than there was in the year previous. So then we come to what has been predicted for next year. Now, as always with predictions, we say it's, you know, take it with a pinch of salt because there's so many moving parts, so many things can happen, so many government schemes could get launched. You just don't know what it could be. But we have Nationwide Building Society, they're predicting house prices will grow between 2 and 4%. On the 4%, that's where that £10,000 figure is coming from. More conservative estimate of 2% would be about five and a half grand. So we're between five and ten grand is what Nationwide is saying. That would be a pretty similar year to what would be going on this year. They predicted. So let's go back to what Nationwide predicted for this year, because we like to keep them on their toes and see how they've done. So they predicted a 0 to 2% fall for this year. So this defied expectations of what they thought was going to happen. Halifax, they think that house prices are going to go up between 0 and 3% next year. For 2024, they predicted a 2 to 4% fall. So again, flying in the face of what was out there. Rightmove are predicting a 4% rise next year. They predicted a 1% fall this year. Zoopla predicting 2.5% next year. They predicted a 2% fall this year. And JLL are predicting a 3.5% rise. They predicted a 3% fall this year. And Chesterton's 3.4% rise next year. They predicted a 0.3% fall. Hampton's 3% rise next year. They predicted flat prices this year. Knight Frank, 2.5% next year. That's what they predict for house prices. They thought they were going to fall 4% this year. And Savills predicting 4% growth next year. They predicted a fall of 3% this year. So what that paints a picture of is that all of those companies are far more upbeat about where house prices are heading next year compared to how downbeat they were for this year. Now, we should add here that the reason why they were so downbeat was we were coming off the back of all of the mortgage madness. There was still a lot of unknowns where mortgage rates were heading. There was a lot more stability now. But there are things that could derail what's going on. So, I mean, the stamp duty deadline is probably boosting prices a little bit at the moment. And lots of people are trying to rush through purchases to beat the stamp duty deadline, which is going to really crunch. It's really going to bite from April. So there's that going on. And of course, mortgage rates could dive around all over the place. You know, it only takes one set of, you know, data that kind of defies expectations to see lenders getting a bit spooked and rates go back up. And a lot of it is linked to the confidence in the mortgage market. So that's where we're at. That's where the predictions are for this year. That's what's happened for next year. This is what happened this year. Stay tuned, Georgie. Let's
Yeah.
have we'll do a rundown again.
Simon, what is the outlook for inflation and interest rates next year, and what are the big potential disruptors that are looming that could impact things?
In terms of the inflation forecast, what we are looking at is inflation going up next year. So we've seen it come down to the 2% target or fall below the 2% target at one point. And we've now got a scenario where the Bank of England is forecasting that it will rise, but probably only to roughly a little bit more than it is now. And then it will start to come down again. And then we're going to head down to below target inflation, sort of 2027 time. The forecast for interest rates, the market forecast for interest rates, is that what we're going to see is another couple of cuts next year. So basically, pretty much divided between whether we're going to see two cuts to four cuts, depending on who you listen to. At the more kind of hawkish end, on UK interest rate expectations, we've got two cuts. At the more bullish end, we've got four cuts. What has influenced that substantially is the Federal Reserve this week, where they actually did cut interest rates in the US, but they also dramatically trimmed their forecasts, and they're much clearer on what they forecast they're going to do with interest rates over there in the US. They trimmed their forecast, they halved the number of cuts they were going to make next year down to two from four. That's what they expect. But to be honest, the Federal Reserve is equally as likely to be wrong with its predictions as anybody else is. So that may not happen. So what we're going to see, the expectation is basically inflation tick up, be a bit stickier on its way down than was previously thought, and interest rates are going to be cut less times. The unknowns, the things that could derail the apple cart over here in the UK is basically the tax rises coming in, the employer's national insurance, what companies do to combat that, combined with what happens to the economy, as we talked about earlier. So, for example, if the economy picks up at the same time as employers bump up prices to deal with their own higher costs, because it's not actually just national insurance, you've got to remember there's also the higher minimum wage as well that impacts quite a lot of those very cost sensitive businesses that do actually have quite a heavy impact on the inflation number. Now, if that feeds through, they put up their prices at the same time as the economy improves, then we might not even see two interest rate cuts. We might not see any interest rate cuts really in a kind of like, that's an outlier though. But on the other hand, if actually prices don't rise by that much and what you see is the economy continuing to slow down, then we might see more interest rate cuts over in the US. Obviously, Donald Trump becomes president. What's he going to do? Is he going to enact his trade war? What's his trade war going to do to US inflation? Is it going to send it through the roof? Is the Federal Reserve going to have to be caught between a rock and a hard place where actually what it wants to be doing is cutting interest rates, but potentially even ends up putting them up because of an inflationary spike caused by this? Or does it look through that and go, well, you know, these are just kind of one-off impositions of the tariffs and so on. And so we think it's going to go away. Who knows?
That's it for part one.
I'm joined now by Rob Morgan of Charles Stanley Direct for our weekly Investing Explained feature. Rob, welcome to this end of year podcast. And I have a question on the US stock market. Why has it done so well this year?
Growth in company earnings has been strong, to be fair, and that's helped drive returns. Although just as impactful is simply the fact that share prices have grown more expensive in relation to their earnings, reflecting greater optimism from investors about the future. And really, it's the technology names that have been at the center of all of this, and the dominance of these exceptional and very large companies has really driven US market returns. Nvidia alone is responsible for about 1/5 of the entire US market increase this year. And the wider Magnificent Seven group of tech companies has been responsible for more than 50% of that move in the S&P 500. So these dominant companies have made a huge contribution. Their performance has been fueled really by excitement surrounding prospects for artificial intelligence and the new products derived from that technology. And on top of all of that, we've had a positive reaction to Donald Trump's victory in the US election, with markets anticipating tax cuts that stand to boost corporate profits. Meanwhile, Trump's stated policies of higher government spending and tariffs on imports, as well as deregulation and sourcing cheap energy, favour lots of US businesses exposed to things like infrastructure build, consumer spending, and financial markets. The US banks, for instance, have also had a remarkable year of share price returns, partly down to that Trump effect. So the big rally we've seen is down to two main things: exuberance about the future returns offered by new AI technology, and the broader effect from that perceived business-friendly approach promised by the president-elect. Investors seeing Trump more as a potential catalyst for growth than a source of instability, for the moment at least. But with valuations quite high, the risk can be seen to be building, so worth looking ahead with some caution.
And how big a difference has this remarkable US rally made to the global stock market?
So it's a really big difference owing to the size of the US market and the fact that gains on Wall Street were not matched elsewhere in the world. So US equities now make up about 70% of world markets. Incredibly, that's more than double the roughly 30% level seen in the 1980s. And an investment in a global tracker fund following, say, the MSCI World Index is increasingly dominated by the US and the major US technology companies. And while the US market performed really well this year, other areas did lag quite a long way behind, notably Europe, which was only up 4% compared to that 25% for the US, hindered as it was by some poor economic performance and not helped by political issues as well. So the US, without the US, the global markets are up about 13% in 2024 to date, compared to about 20% if you include the US. So it is a more subdued performance from almost all other markets.
Rob, thank you very much.
Thank you, Simon.
Welcome back. We've mentioned it a couple of times already on the pod, but in case you've been living on the moon for the past 6 months, you might have noticed that we've had significant elections, shall we say, on both sides of the pond. Labour wasted no time in peeing lots of people off, financially speaking, particularly the elderly farmers, business owners, entrepreneurs and waspy women. And Trump, well, Trump is just doing Trump, but 2.0. So firstly, I mean, we couldn't talk about 2024 without the budget mentioned. Lee, Labour, I said peeing off. They went hard early, didn't they, with the winter fuel payments. They weren't making any friends quickly, were they? And it was miserable talk as well. Simon mentioned miserabilism.
Yeah, well, it was a couple of months after the election of just, I've never known such a feeding frenzy before a budget. It was crazy. And we've spoken about this in the podcast when it was happening. There just was nothing really taken off of the table, which meant the table was full of things that we weren't sure what was going to kind of make it. And as a result, people did make decisions, financial decisions. There was a lot of panic. It really was, for me, probably not the way to run your first budget. But look, you know, I don't want to go into the whole politics of this, but it was pretty crazy. It was a crazy time. And then the aftermath has just seen, of the budget this is, has just seen a lot of people, our readers, our listeners, incredibly confused about where the land lie in terms of things like inheritance and pensions, tax, And, you know, we've got employers that have obviously come out and been quite vocal about how much bigger their bill is going to be because of NI. So, look, there's lots going on since that budget, and there was a lot going on in the run-up to the budget. And it really did take centre stage to the new government. And as you say, it's all felt a bit miserable. You know, usually a new government, wave of optimism, you know, you get a few things moving and shaking, you know, gee us all up, give us a bit of a bounce, new manager bounce. There hasn't been a new manager bounce, it doesn't feel like. And I get it, you know, there's lots of talk of obviously the financial black hole and the aftermath of how much and how expensive the pandemic was, for example, and trying to make moves to make, you know, dent in all of that kind of thing. But it feels like the dust has settled, and it does not feel like there's really that many cohorts of people that have been entirely happy. As you were saying there, you know, this week we had the kind of WASPI decision. You know, I'm not going to argue about the rights and wrongs of all of that. And actually, do you know what? I think a decision had to be made on that pretty early door. So actually, I would applaud the government for, you know, making a decision either way, you know, rather than just kicking the can down the road, dilly-dallying all of the time. But you also, there's a lot of those people are the same people that have had their winter fuel payment cut, you know, and being means tested. So you can understand where the kind of anger in that lay. And then, you know, our own personal taxes, and this is from the previous government, you know, the stealth taxes, the us, more of us getting hoovered into becoming higher rate taxpayers, you know, not pinning that on Labour, I'm pinning that on the previous guys. It's been a testy few years for our own personal finances and for those that aspire to build wealth. That's how it feels. Now, what goes on into next year? There's lots of things on the table, lots of reviews and lots of where the decision making is going to come in. And there's always going to be difficult decisions to make as a new government, and totally understand that. So it feels like a lot is kind of still being sorted. And I had quite a long run up to kind of have more plans ready to go. It's how it feels to me. People listening to this might disagree and think actually they've come in and done a fantastic job, and that's your prerogative. But next year, it's just, I think it's going to be a real, real crucial one in terms of building the foundations for the rest of the time in Parliament, and I think crucially trying to make people feel like they're getting richer rather than constantly feeling like their money's being clawed away from them all the time, and ever growing amounts of money is being clawed away from them when they're working hard and harder and harder. That's my viewpoint.
Yeah, indeed. Thank you, Lee. Simon, how do you think the budget particularly will play out short and long term? I mean, we've heard about where it will hit inflation very specifically, but also our personal finances. So Lee mentioned there about inheritance tax and pensions that won't come in until 2027. So, you know, there's some long and short term impacts that this will have. What do you see? Are you mildly optimistic? Are you wildly optimistic? Are you pessimistic? What do you reckon?
Well, I'm always optimistic, right? That's my default setting. I'm a glasses more than half full person. However, I must admit that I am getting increasingly disheartened by what is going on in the terms of the framework around our finances, our personal finances and our national finances. And I just don't see things getting better. And I was very much hoping that the arrival of the new government would involve some form of blank slate, you know, approach from Rachel Reeves, who I think has it in her to be a good chancellor. I think that we need to sort out the tax system that is basically disincentivizing people from working. We have now got to the point where there is a cottage industry in this country in trying to earn less money in order to avoid various tax traps. You've got things like the child benefit trap. You've got the 60% tax trap where people are paying 60% on every extra pound they earn between 100,000 and 125,000. And we have dragged so many more people into those things. There's the higher rate tax element. And I always used to think that this thing of people saying, well, it's not worth me doing the work because, like, you know, after tax, I won't get that much money, was absolute nonsense. And people would always do more work to get more money. But I think we have trapped ourselves in a doom loop of some of the most productive people in this country thinking like that, of thinking, well, there's no point in me taking on the extra work because actually by the time I've paid the tax and everything, I'm not going to get that much from it. And because they don't have the pricing power to drive up the amount of money that they would get paid for doing the work, and they're so acutely aware of the tax situation, they're now, someone says to them, I'll pay you 200 quid to do this. In their head, they go, yeah, I'm only going to see 100 quid of that. No point. And I think this is a genuine issue that we now have, and it is holding us back. So I would have liked to have seen our personal taxes sorted out. We've got ourselves into a right pickle with this, because every time we go round, you know, the loop, we add another layer on top, another layer on top, another layer on top. And the more it happens, the more people basically hunker down. And they save money rather than they spend money. They don't take risks and so on and things like that. And that's where I think maybe this thing with pensions and inheritance is a big mistake. Okay. Actually, you could argue that maybe it's going to encourage, you know, people with pensions to start spending their pensions and giving away their pensions. And I would like to think that actually there's probably someone in the Treasury thinking, you know, like, yeah, like, this will get those boomers to start spending those pension pots rather than wait until they die. But I don't think that that is what's going to happen. I think what's going to happen is you're seeing like the wealthiest generation that's ever lived, the boomer generation, is like, they are such savers. They really are. They really struggle to get their head round, like moving from accumulation to decumulation. And every time we hit people with all this negative news and all this kind of stuff, they just hunker down a bit more and they save a bit more and they save a bit harder. There's loads of them wandering around complaining about how they don't have any money. Actually, lots of them have got lots of money. They need to start spending their money and enjoying it and enjoy the rest of their lives and the rewards of their hard work. And then we would be in a better position and growth in this country would be higher. I think we also have a problem where, you know, to allude to what I was talking about earlier in terms of who's going to build all these houses, we are so reliant on an older workforce at the moment, okay? A lot of the people who are doing the, you know, electricians, plumbers, roofers, etc., even like in the building trade, you know, that whole thing, the backbone of that is, quite a lot of them is people in their 50s and 60s, okay, and some of them in their 70s. And when they decide that they are going to stop working, we've got a problem because we're not training up enough of those people. So I'd like to have seen us start to try to unpick some of these things and like get ourselves moving, go, right, okay, reset, come on, let's go. And it hasn't happened. So overall, I'm just largely disappointed.
I mean, in the defense of Labour, or any...
They were given a hospital pass.
Oh, do you know what I mean? Like,
sorry to cut you off there, but they, yeah. I'm the first to admit they got a massive hospital pass.
But also, like, it's only been sort of six months or however long since they came in. These things take time. And, you know, maybe next year they will start looking at making significant change. But I've been reading Failed State, the book by Sam Friedman, Why Nothing Works and How We Fix It. And it just makes, oh my God, what a mess it's all in. You think, oh, it's all politicians' fault, but my God, the whole system is completely like in a mess. So how we fix it, well, I don't know. I've not got to that part of the book, but I'm hoping it's going to be some fantastic idea and it's going to be brought in. But Lee, what are you... as optimistic, are you as pessimistic? I don't know, Simon, you say you're optimistic. That didn't sound very optimistic.
No, I am optimistic. I think because I think there comes a point where we all just get so fed up with this that we just all pull our socks up and sort stuff out. It's got to the point where the people in charge have been quite useless for quite a long time. And, you know, I'm not going to pass judgment on the people in charge right now because they have only been in charge for a certain amount of time. What I am hugely disappointed about is two things. One, they wasted all of the positive sentiment and optimism that came from a new government by spending the next 4 months wandering around being really miserable. And I mean, they caused the biggest crash in consumer confidence at one point since Russia invaded Ukraine. That is impressive. Okay.
Yeah.
You have to take your hat off to that kind of thing. And secondly, I think the budget was rubbish. So I won't pass judgment on that, but I do. I'm optimistic. So I think as a nation, like the reason why I'm saying is people are writing books like that. People are writing articles like that. People are saying, come on, we've got to sort this stuff out. OK, we've got to stop falling behind. And I think eventually we'll just get people power that lifts us up.
There we go, Lee.
Yeah, I'm optimistic too, Georgie. Yeah, sorry, I sometimes probably come across as quite pessimistic. It's not pessimism, it's actually just wanting what I think is best for this country and making sure that we're all pulling in the right direction and, our wealth is growing and that, people that are working hard are rewarded for what they do. But, as Simon, I echo what Simon says, we're resilient people. And, I look around and, see how people sort of live their lives from working in Kensington, one of the most affluent areas, of Europe, all the way to sort of this part of Essex that I'm in, which is not exactly the most affluent. So, I see everyone from all sorts of positions and walks of life. And I think on the whole, there is always a bit of a wave of optimism. I always think that people just, we love to moan, we love to kind of grumble, but fundamentally, a lot of people in many households do the right things and are building things like financial resilience by building up pension pots, by investing, by saving, and yes, getting upset about potentially how much of a tax take for is the country improving? Is the infrastructure improving? Are the services improving? Well, yeah. We're gonna end it on a pessimistic note. Everything's gonna be fine. We are gonna have a good rest of this decade. Okay, that's my viewpoint. We're halfway through it. It's gonna be good. The rest of the 20s is gonna be good.
Excellent. Good to hear it. Simon, before we sort of put these predictions and what's happened over the last year to bed, I want to talk about investing. And I mentioned there, particularly what's been going on in the States. The US market's surging. We've got the Magnificent Seven. We've got the UK is up. Bitcoin is through the roof. What's been going on this year in the world of investing?
In the world of investing, this year has been totally dominated once again by the Magnificent Seven, the bunch of US tech stocks that just keep absolutely flying. We've seen increasing concentration in the stock market. And as these companies keep getting bigger, it just gets more and more concentrated. In fact, we had a remarkable report out actually from AJ Bell this week talking about their manager versus machine report. And it showed that just a third of fund managers have outperformed a tracker over the last 10 years. And in 2024 to date, it was just 31% who managed that achievement. So that is basically only 31% of fund managers managed to just beat a cheap tracker fund. And a lot of this, when you look at it globally, is the Magnificent Seven effect. And to put this in context, basically, to match a passive fund, an active manager would now have to hold a third of their portfolio in Magnificent Seven stocks. That's a huge amount of concentration. And also, if you look at the Magnificent Seven and their share price performance over the last year, the one that has been the straggler, the one that's disappointed out of them all, is Microsoft. Microsoft shares are only up 18% this year. Imagine being the straggler in a bunch of seven and your shares were only up 18% in 1 year. That compares to the next lowest performer being Apple, whose shares are only up 35% this year, Alphabet 36%, Amazon, poor old Jeff Bezos, his company's only managed a 49% share price return this year. Meta, that's up 72%. Tesla, aided in part by Elon Musk's new bromance with Donald Trump, is up 76%. And then Nvidia, I mean, that's up a mere 171% this year. Absolutely astonishing, those figures. Now, the question is, when does this stop? This can't continue on forever. But it keeps wrong-footing investors who find themselves in the position of going, well, logically, I probably shouldn't, allocate that much money to these stocks, which are absolutely flying because they can't just keep going up like this forever, but then getting caught out because they do keep going up. So ultimately, if you'd have just held a global tracker fund, you'd have done pretty well this year. The MSCI, ACWI, All World Index is up 15%. But if you just held an S&P 500 tracker, you'd have a 24% return. And actually, what's really interesting about that MSCI Global Index return is that if you take the USA out, you go from a 15% return to only a 1.6% return, which is absolutely astonishing. Which brings us back to the whole, well, what's going to happen next year? I mean, as I just said, who knows? Can
Who
those
knows?
big tech stocks keep going up? There's a lot of people betting on the fact that they can, although actually stuff has come off the boil a bit over the last couple of weeks. Donald Trump is seen as being very tech friendly. And this matters because ultimately the US stock market makes up 70% of the global market. That's why that matters to us in the UK. And if you have a pension, if you have investments, you're going to hold funds in global funds, you're going to hold money in tracker funds, and you are going to be heavily exposed to this. So what happens there really does directly impact your money. And it also has an impact on markets around the world, because if the US market sinks, everything else is probably going to sink. Due to, contagion from it. Whether it will sink as much, we don't know. The UK stock market has had quite a good year. The FTSE 100 is up 4%, but that's actually nowhere near as good as it was a few weeks ago when it was up about 8%. We've had a real sell-off over the last few weeks. Although if you add in the kind of dividend return, you'd be getting an 8% return. And an 8% return in any normal year is absolutely great. Just doesn't look as good as when you compare it to a 24% return from the S&P 500, which is why people keep lumping money into the S&P 500. And so the cycle continues until it stops. But we don't know when that point is that it's going to stop.
No, we don't, Simon. Right, on a slightly lighter note, I don't know, it might not be lighter, it depends. I want to ask both of you your favourite stories of the year. Lee.
Oh, Georgie, that's difficult. Do you know what? It's been another absolute stellar year for This Is Money. Our reporters have really gone above and beyond to entertain, inform our readership. I'm going to pick. I'm going to be quite straight laced here. I'm going to pick something that I've been involved in very much because it has been the lighter side of what we do at This Is Money, and that's our Modern Treasures series that's written by Dan Hatfield. I think it's been a great series that we've launched earlier this year. We've had Fendi handbags bought in charity shops that have been worth a fortune. We've had a Paddington special where someone sent in their old 1970s Paddington bear. We've had NatWest piggy banks. We've had signed pictures of the Beatles. We have had a Damon Hirst print that was won in a competition. I think all of those things are great. And what I love about that series and why I launched it in the first place is I love to think about people's kind of modern treasures that they've got laying around at home, maybe up in the loft, maybe in the garage. And I'd actively encourage you to spend some of the Christmas digging some of this stuff out. Your old vinyls, your old computer games, anything that is kind of a bit modern, like 70s, 80s, 90s, that retro vibe. I love reading what people send in and looking for the images. And actually, we kick the series off in May with a couple of first edition Jurassic Park, as a Jurassic Park book and In Cold Blood book. But then the next one we did, when we had a flurry of people get in touch, was Beanie Babies. Now, Beanie Babies, ever since we did that, we have had hundreds and hundreds of emails from around the world of people's Beanie Babies and their collections. And it just makes you realize that lots of people do collect quite hard, something quite specific. And if that's you, and if you're listening to that, or you know someone, so that, please do get in touch, editor at thisismoney.co.uk, and we'll get Dan to have a look into it. But I think it's the lighter side of what we do. With all the investigative stuff we kind of do, and the exclusives, and the real hard financial news, especially all of the inheritance tax and pensions things that we've been doing in recent months. It's nice to have the light and shade, I think, sometimes on the This Is Money homepage, and I think that the Modern Treasure series is definitely the light.
All right, Simon.
Okay, I'm going to go for a story that came from our new financial planning channel that we launched earlier this year and has done phenomenally well. We're doing a lot of stories that are often, basically, primarily 90% of them are just questions that we've been sent in by our readers asking us, their financial planning questions. People love reading these, and it's actually a really great way of explaining financial topics to people because they can latch on to something in that question form in a way that they otherwise don't. But my standout one was very early in this series when we got an email sent to us that was one of those emails where you're like, huh? Really? Is this real? It was real. I'm inheriting £10 million. Can I set up an investment trust to manage it for my family and cut tax? I love that. You've got to love it when you get an email into your inbox saying, yeah, I'm about to inherit £10 million. What should I do? absolutely brilliant. But on the other end of like helping out people on a much smaller and sometimes larger scale, but on aggregate, a large scale, I would go for Helen Crane's Crane on the Case column that she wrote earlier this year, where she marked her 100th Crane on the Case column. And this is people writing into us because they have been wronged in some way. And often they have been wronged over, you know, a couple of £100, but they've tried to sort it out and the people just have not sorted it out for them. The companies do such a bad job that eventually they've ended up having to get in touch with us. And the headline on that column is, I'm a consumer champion and I have won back £1.2 million for readers. £1.2 million worth Helen won back for people over those 100 columns. And she's continued to win back more over the course of the year. And that, I think, is absolutely at the heart of what we try to do at This Is Money, which is basically standing up for our readers, fighting their corner and helping them out.
Quite. And also helping them find hidden stuff in their loft that they can sell. Anyway, we are running out of time, but it's podcast reader question time. And the winner of the This Is Money mug is Michael. Well done, Michael. I just wanted to start by saying how much I love the This Is Money podcast. Did we really just introduce this question so that we could just get a big love in? It's been incredibly insightful and helpful. So well done, Lee and Simon. So I used Vanguard to invest in their Life Strategy 80 fund. I only have a small amount invested as I started this year, but I love their product and the simplicity of it. However, having heard about the fee changes and the introduction of a minimum amount, I'm now looking to move my ISA elsewhere. Trading 212 seems good, as does InvestEngine, but I'm not sure which ETFs to invest in as this was all taken care of with Vanguard. Any help on where to start would be greatly appreciated. I usually have a high-risk approach due to the time between now and retirement, for which I'm mainly saving.
Vanguard has shaken up its fees, and that has really shaken people up who love cheap investing. Now, it should be said that this new £4 fee, which would amount to £48 a year, is only on accounts that have a balance of less than £32,000. And even though that will see many of those people face a substantial rise in what they're paying to use Vanguard's platform, it is still incredibly cheap. £4 a month is really not a lot. Let's measure it in the classic modern day measurement of coffees. Most people spend more than that on coffee in a week. Even people who don't buy lots of coffees tend to spend more than that on coffee in a week. You might not drink coffee. It might be tea. It might be something else. Measure it in your chosen modern day use measurement. Okay. It's really not a lot of money, but if you are trying to get the absolute lowest investing costs, then it is possible to get them down further. Also, it is worth noting that if you're paying this £48 a year charge, then you need to measure that versus your return, and it could eat up all of your return in 1 year. So, for example, you know, £48 on, if you made a £1,000 return, that's, you know, 4.8% of it. So, you know, 4.8% return in a year, that would be pretty reasonable. Might all get eaten up by fees. So that's why it matters to people. And actually, costs are one of the things that you can control. But to go back to the question, the absolute cheapest places that you can invest are places like, for example, Trading 212, which don't charge any account fees, but you can't buy investment funds there. And most people will be holding Vanguard investment funds. You can buy Vanguard ETFs. If you buy a Vanguard ETF, then it will come with a slightly higher charge. If you've got a relatively small amount of money, actually, you might be better off going for one of the traditional investment platforms that charges a percentage-based fee, because a percentage-based fee on that smaller amount isn't so much. Charles Stanley Direct, for example, the sponsors of this podcast, if you had £5,000 invested in funds and you did 12 ad hoc trades per year, it would only cost you £18, which is substantially cheaper than that £48 at Vanguard now. So what you need to do is you need to go to thisismoney.co.uk/platforms, where you will find our roundup of the best and cheapest DIY investing platforms. Have a read through, choose the one that's right for you. Don't just base it on cost, base it on how you're going to invest as well. And that will help you get the right answer for yourself.
Lovely. Thank you, Simon. And finally, your stat of the week. Or indeed, stat of the year, Simon. I mean, I don't mind.
No, I'm going stat of the week. Stat of the week. Fair. Okay, so the stat of the week is that Argentina's monthly inflation rate has slowed to 2.4% in November. Right. Now, the eagle-eared will notice that that is lower than the UK's 2.6% inflation rate. The even more eagle-eared will notice that I said Argentina's monthly inflation rate. Monthly inflation in Argentina is at 2.4%, the lowest it's been in over 4 years. Annual inflation in Argentina, however, is at 166%.
Wow.
The good news is that's down from 193%, though.
Wow, that is a good stat, Simon. Thank you very much. That's it for this week. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Simon.
Well, I'll tell you how you can do that in a minute. But before I do that, I'm going to wish you all a very Merry Christmas. Thank you very much for listening to the podcast. I hope you've had a good 2024. I hope you have an amazing 2025. We do have another episode coming out next week. Okay, don't miss that. But Merry Christmas from all of us on the podcast. Me,
Merry
Georgie,
Christmas.
Lee, Helen, Tanya, everybody else who takes part in the podcast. And if you want to contact us, you can do that at podcast@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us at thisismoney and you can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast.
Quite. Well said, Simon. Very Merry Christmas. And if you like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.
Take control of your finances with Charles Stanley Direct. Invest, save, coach, or plan. Using technology where it's helpful and people where it matters. Our website and app make trading cost-effective and flexible. But we're more than just an online investment service. We're here for you regardless of your financial needs or if your life takes an unexpected turn. Your finances, your way. Take control today with Charles Stanley Direct. Sign up now.
Investment involves risk.